The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wigginton. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wigginton.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Tuesday Space Show program. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in on the 24th of March, 2020. And we have a great show for you tonight with Bob Zimmerman. And most of you who, everyone who listens to the Space Show and has for years knows who Bob is. So you either love him or you hate him. But Bob is back with us tonight with some interesting space news and updates and perspectives. We'll get more in line with Bob in just a minute. We're on a 90-minute program tonight. So
2 hours.
Well, we'll see how the traffic is, Bob.
2 hours. Always 2 hours.
We'll see how the traffic is, Bob. I'm like a struck record. If nobody's calling you and nobody wants to talk to you, it won't be 2 hours. It may be 5 minutes if people don't want to talk to you. Friday night, there is no Hotel Mars as far as I know, because Mr. Batchelor has not responded to any of my emails since last week.
And I can answer why.
Why is he?
They're having lots of studio issues there.
Well,
one of the people in the studio actually was diagnosed with it, and so they've lost some access time.
Is John okay?
Oh, yeah, he's fine. Everything's fine. But that's one of the reasons, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I haven't even been introduced. But the podcast I did with him last week was supposed to air on Friday. Didn't get aired until Tuesday. He didn't do a show on Friday.
Well, I wish he would take 2 seconds to respond and say no show this week or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, no Hotel Mars. Friday is Dr. Tina Highfill. She's on the blog, and she's with the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and this is going to be fun because her organization, which is a government organization, did an incredible space industry economic report, but it was all pre-virus, and we'll get to ask her how she sees economically what's going on with the space industry vis-a-vis this report she did. The report is referenced and linked on our blog and in our upcoming show menu. I think that's where I put it. So you can see what she has to do. And then under popular request about 2 months ago, those of you who just think space solar power is the end-all to be-all, my first jaunt into the Naval Research Lab world. I finally got a guest after almost 20 years to come in from NRL. I cannot believe it is happening. They have been a holdout for 20 years. Dr. Paul Jaffe is with us regarding his 3D solar project, which many of you requested that we feature on the Space Show. So Dr. Jaffe will be with us on Sunday, and he wants the full 90-minute program. So everybody can look forward to Dr. Paul Jaffe, 3D Solar Project, Naval Research Lab, Sunday. So the remainder of the week is very, very good, very exciting, good topics to talk about, and we'll see how they all go. So for tonight, our toll-free number is 866-687-7223. Remember, we are a talk show. That means we like to talk, and that means we want you to talk with us. So please use the phone rather than email, 1-866-687-7223. If you must use email, of course use it. We'll take your emails, we'll read them on the air, and we'll be very, very happy campers. But telephone is always better. Blogs are fine, too. You can post a comment on our blog. So go to thespaceshow.com, far right, upcoming show menu. Open up the first page for Bob Zimmerman. Scroll all the way down to the bottom, and you'll see the area for comments and questions. And post what it is you want, and as soon as you hit the send button, I'll get a copy of it and can bring up your question or comment for Bob during the program. Our full website newsletter for this week is listed upper right of our website. Remember, everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our site, or you can download shows very quickly. When you look at the website newsletter, scroll down. We added a couple of shows between now and the end of the second quarter. We're still filling out second quarter, although I have to admit it's going slower than usual, and I'm assuming that's because people are preoccupied with the virus, whether they're shut in or sheltered or threatened with their job or lost their job or whatever. So, but we're still filling our second quarter dates, and your guest suggestions are always welcome, and we do follow up on every one of them, and we thank you for that. The new website newsletter, as I said, is posted. You'll see that upper right on our website. Everything we do is archived. Don't forget we have a store for Space Show logo wear. Just click on any of the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and she'll guide you to our Cafe Press store. Then remember also, and this, of course, is always very important, we're a nonprofit 501c3, and we are listener-supported, which means you, the listener, you help support us with your financial contributions, and we thank you for that. If you are a federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. There's a huge PayPal button at the top of our homepage, easy to use. And then, of course, if you don't want to use PayPal and would like to use a check, it is to 1ONE Giant Leap Foundation, and then care of me at P.O. Box 95, Tiburon, California. And we appreciate your support, and we need your support. In addition, we have sponsors, and remember, the sponsors get those banner ads running across their homepage, which they can change as often as they like. And on the longer shows like today with Bob, I will read their short sponsor messages, but I'll do it when we break between first and second segment. But we would not be doing our program without our great sponsors, and they need shout-outs, and they need support, and we're really grateful. And a couple of them had to cancel their events, but I'll mention that when we read out our sponsor messages in a few minutes. Bob Zimmerman is back with us, so he is the most frequent Space Show guest of all Space Show guests over all the past 19-plus years. Bob holds the record as having been on the show the most times, which tells me that all of you don't really need to know anything about Bob because you probably already know about him. He has a fabulous website that you should be tracking probably several times a day. It not only focuses on space, but on technology and some politics and some entertainment, and it's a great site, BehindTheBlack.com. Bob is a well-known author. He's a historian. And, you know, he really knows his stuff, and we're happy to have him with us. His full bio is listed on our website, so you can read about him at your convenience, which, and I hope you do read about him. We're going to talk to Bob, who was originally on this show tonight, to talk about a conference that is no longer a conference. And I will let him tell you about that. Bob, welcome back. How are you?
David, I'm glad to be here, as always. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and your audience. Last week was scheduled the 51st Annual Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Texas near Houston. And this conference has been going on since the Apollo missions. It was actually originally... Its original purpose was to discuss the science that had come from the Apollo samples and the lunar exploration that the U.S. was doing. And they, over time, they just kept doing it, and there was always more discoveries, and so they expanded it out. And it's become an annual. It had become an annual event for planetary scientists to give their updates on the work they're doing. And I had reported on it extensively last year, remotely and realized, you know, I really should have been here. And the webpage is doing so well that I'm now making enough money that I can devote some of that money to actually traveling to conferences that I think are worthwhile attending. And so I was going to attend that conference last week, but then the universe went insane, and conferences left and right were closed and shut down, and this was one of them. And so without a conference, there was nothing to go to. But the program had already been posted online. And so I decided, well, I'm going to go, and the program included abstracts from every single planned oral presentation, as well as the posters. And I decided, I should, you know what, let's make believe I'm there. If I was there on Monday, let's look at the presentations that were going to be on Monday, and the same thing on Tuesday and Wednesday, right down the line, so I could report on at least what the abstracts say. Most of the abstracts give you a pretty good idea of what the research is and what the results are. Some of those abstracts don't. They say, we will be presenting our results X. And so in those cases, I can't really say anything more than, oh, gee, there was something interesting there. And so I posted daily last week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, updates on what I call the non-existent Lunar and Planetary Science Conference. But there are some interesting results from that conference, from the abstracts, that I think your listeners, David, are going to be really interested in hearing. I think that to me, over the whole conference, the most interesting result was actually, you know, they usually put the most newsworthy press, the most newsworthy results the first day. But to me, actually, it was the last day on Friday, the last half day. They had a session on Mars. And they had sessions on Mars all through the week in which they talked about Curiosity results and Insights results and a few other results. You know, for example, with Curiosity, it's pretty clear now it's been moving out of a zone on in Gale Crater that had geology that was created by underwater processes, meaning it was once a lake, and it's now moving literally up out of that lake territory into geology that was formed by flowing water. And that was what they featured on the first day, and that's very cool. And that's very recent results from Curiosity. I have a post on my website from 2 weeks ago when it had managed to top a plateau to make its highest point yet on Mount Sharp, and that put it in terrain that was very clearly, they think, never underwater. This will be confirmed in a year or two, but the initial preliminary data says it was never underwater. So that was what they featured on the first day, but to me the last day had the most significant thing, and it wasn't any particular result. The session was mostly about a variety of things, but they all came down to one thing. There were 10 in this one session on Mars. There were 13 paper abstracts, and of those 13, 10 described some sort of evidence of buried ice or glaciers on Mars in all sorts of places. And the three, by the way, that were not about finding ice on Mars were about talking about glaciers on Earth for purposes of comparison. And they found evidence on Mars of water at the top of one of the largest volcanoes. They found evidence of ice in the faults and fissures near the equator, which is significant. They found evidence of water on the eastern margin of one of Mars' deep basins. They've got two big ones. Hellas is the most well-known, but Argai is the other. They found evidence of ice in Gale Crater. They found evidence of ice in the transition zone between the northern lowlands and the southern hot cratered highlands. And the northern lowlands is where some theorize there was maybe once an ocean, intermittent ocean, but without question, that's the other thing. There were numerous reports that found evidence of ice in the northern mid-latitude lowlands, which is not a surprise. There's been tons of that. This is one of the reasons SpaceX, its primary candidate landing site for Starship, is in the northern lowlands. So all those reports, plus I've been reporting on this from Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter now for the last 2 years on Behind the Black, the number of glacial evidence on Mars is ubiquitous. And what these results are all telling me is not, you know, a lot of times the press doesn't really know what it's talking about when it reports on Mars, so it makes a big deal about the discovery of water ice on Mars. Well, that's not the story. Ice is very plentiful. This is not a discovery anymore. But its presence and behavior as glaciers, as snowfall, as an underground aquifer, there's lots of evidence of what they call an ice table, like we call a water table on much of Mars, and there's real questions how low a latitude it gets. That ice makes it a major factor, maybe, in explaining the geology we see on Mars. And the big question about the Mars geology is that you have, all the evidence of river channels, and what we see immediately looks like canyons formed by water flow. And scientists for almost 50 years now, since the first Mariner 9 orbiters, first Mariner 9 orbiter back in 71, have been trying to explain how water could have flowed on the surface of Mars despite its much too thin atmosphere and much too cold temperatures. They're trying to figure out how then maybe the climate could have been different one day and allowed water to flow. And I will tell you that they have yet to succeed in this. This is a conundrum that has not been solved. And it could very well be that the reason it can't be solved is they're looking at the wrong answer. That it very well could be that it's the ice that we see everywhere on Mars that formed these geological features, not flowing water. And, of course, that is my speculation, but it's based on what I'm noticing from talking to a lot of scientists, reading a lot of these papers and abstracts. I'm getting the sense that among the planetary scientists doing this research, there is an increasing consideration that maybe ice is the cause. Now, this is not a dominant theory, or it's not even popular, or they're very careful about saying so because no one's really worked it out, but that I'm seeing it increasingly tells me that this is maybe where we're going. And if that's the case, it would solve the number one geological problem of Mars. And, one of the reasons we didn't think of ice initially is because we don't think of ice as producing these kind of gigantic structures. But, once again, Mars is alien. It's got a very, very, it's got a one-third gravity. It's got a different kind of atmosphere. The chemistry is different. The materials are different. So water itself, ice itself, might actually produce different results. And that's in combination with the fact that the inclination, the tilt of its rotation, unlike the Earth, it shifts much more, and that produces climate change over cycles, over many centuries and eons. It's similar to our ice ages for the same reason, but because the tilt of Mars can be much more extreme, it can go from 25 degrees to 60 degrees. The Earth never does that. It produces incredible cycles of change, and that moves the glacier and the ice all around the planet from one place to another. And that could also be a contributing factor. And this is all what the cutting-edge research now on Mars. And so I think that, to me, was the most significant thing that came out of the conference. There's lots of other stuff, David. For example, Ceres. There was reports on looking at the data from the Dawn space, a spacecraft that flew with Ceres for a period of time. Several presentations suggested that they now think the crust of Ceres could be an ice shell, with one abstract proposing that crust has a content of water that's 80% ice. That would explain, by the way, the cryogenic volcanoes they think they see there. There were several sections on the results from Hayabusa 2 and Osiris Rex. Hayabusa 2 is coming home with samples. Osiris Rex is getting ready to get its first samples, and they were giving some reports on its results. The most interesting to me from Osiris Rex is they found rocks on the surface that appear to have different textures lined up like layers. And there's no way you can get sedimentary rocks, sedimentary layers on Bennu. It's a rubble pile. It's never been crushed. It's a rubble pile. So that means those boulders and rocks came from a parent body that was impacted, threw off a lot of debris that eventually consolidated together to produce Bennu, the rubble pile. And that parent's body had to have existed long enough and get big enough to have sedimentary layers of some kind form. So that was interesting. I mean, I'm just going down the conference, lots of stuff about the moon and looking at the South Pole for both water and also future exploration. A lot of scientists doing research on Shackleton and the areas that the Trump administration wants to land in 2024, a manned mission. And of course, I don't, let's not talking about whether that mission is actually going to happen or not. The science and the potential exploration is really interesting. They really focus on really specific places. The one part of the rim of Shackleton Crater, they now have pinned down very precisely that it has illumination about 80% of the time on the surface. But if you were to put, if you were to stand just 30 feet above the surface, you would get continuous sunlight for periods of up to 175 days continuously, with the longest darkness periods only less than 3 days. So that's a significant amount of light. And so that's a place they would like to go, and some people actually did research on how you could land there possibly. One pointed out that this is really rough terrain. A rover would be really useful. We won't get into whether or not it's going to happen, but it's just the science there is interesting. And, of course, I'm sure there were Chinese scientists taking notes for their own missions to go there. There was more stuff on the future landers that are going to go to Mars, both Perseverance that's scheduled for launch in July and its landing site in Jezero Crater. You know, the geology there, how important it is. And there was a whole session on Mercury. Mercury, this is now digging into the archives of Mercury, of the messenger mission that orbited Mercury for several years. And that's missions long gone, but they have the data. And so scientists are still digging into that archives. And one of the things they're trying to figure out is the interior structure of Mercury. It's core, how big is the iron core? How big is the mantle? How big is the crust? How thick? The belief right now is the mantle and crust are relatively thin. And that's not different from before, but then the question is there any liquid portions of that interior? And that's still unclear. To quote one paper, the structure of Mercury's interior remains ambiguous and still leaves room for speculation. As I like to say, the uncertainty of science, it's profound. They looked at the differences between Mercury and the Moon. You know, you look at Mercury and the Moon, at a first glance, you think they're really very similar. Lots of craters, very dark. Some lava plains, the mare on the moon, you get the same thing on Mercury. But a close look, they are not that similar. And for one thing, Mercury is much darker. And they're trying to figure that out. They had theories. Those theories were disproven by MESSENGER when it got there. Now there are some theories that were abstracts for the non-existent conference, that suggest maybe carbon is the explanation. You know, these asteroids are always very dark, but it's got a lot of carbon. So they may be suggesting that. There's some research on what they think might be ice in the permanently shadowed craters in Mercury at the poles, just like the moon. One paper looked specifically at one polar crater, Ensor, which they think has maybe ice, and they came up with a different result. They said it looks instead like there might be, quote, complex organic volatile compounds. Now, that's not life. Organic here is used as chemists use it, any molecule that uses the element carbon in it. And so you can get a lot of carbon molecules, like soot, for example, that is not life. But these are complex organic compounds, and so that's interesting. That's not water, though. Lots more. I don't know if you saw any of my papers. I could go on. For example, there are vents. There are about over 100 vents on Mercury. They find them mostly at the base of craters, and they are not located anywhere near the Mare lava plain regions. Those volcanic vents, therefore, are associated with possibly the impact itself. That's an interesting question. So, anyway, that's a quick overview, David. I mean, if readers have any other questions, listeners, I'd be glad to talk about it.
Well, let's see if they do. Let me ask you this. I didn't send it to you. I got it from a listener earlier in the day, and it's from something called TMF Associates blog, and it is a it was written on the 21st of March, so it's fairly current.
Yeah.
And it says why SpaceX desperately needs a government bailout. So did you see this article?
I did not see that article. I did see a few that. Yeah, all right. Well, anyway, tell me more about it.
Well, I'm going to send it to you.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
I really can't summarize on there, but it talks about what they're doing, their burn rate, their projects, that they're not able to raise capital, that he went to.
What?
Wait a
what?
Minute. He
go
went
ahead.
To,
all right, go
he,
ahead.
He went
sorry.
To Satellite 2020, laid a total egg.
What laid a total egg?
Musk that laid a total egg when he went to Satellite 2020. They describe what happened. And, he has to get a lot of capital, and he's got an incredible burn rate with projects going on. He's consuming over $100 million a month, and his income is down from 2 years ago. His valuation that was given for the stock's value is no longer relevant given what's happened to the stock market. And they're saying that the Commercial Space Federation has said that there needs to be a government bailout for SpaceX and other space industries.
Well, all right, let me interrupt here because I can tell you right off the bat.
That's a summary that I can give you.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, all right. Except I have a March 10th post that I put up on Behind the Black whereby SpaceX had decided it was going to do another investment capital round trying to raise
right.
some private capital, and their goal had been to raise $250 million. And the result was they raised half a billion, twice as much as planned. And that means that in the last year, they have raised in investment capital, private investment or loans, $1.83 billion. That's a lot of capital is raised.
Well,
that doesn't sound to me like they're short of capital or capital or in
you,
their,
you need to
their
read
capital. They're in trouble. And let me add one other detail. There was an interview that I also posted on Behind the Black from the guy in charge of their Starlink project. And I had assumed that a lot of the capital being raised here was for use in Starlink as well as Starship to develop both. And the guy in charge of Starlink said, nope, we're funding Starlink entirely in-house. We don't want to give up any of our potential profits from that. So we are financing that ourselves.
Okay, so you need to read the article.
Okay, I will read it. I'll be glad to read it. But I'm telling you what I already know. So it strikes me as contradicting significantly what I already know. And that's interesting. I'd like to find out why there's a contradiction.
Okay, do you know what happened with their Reg D forms in the SEC?
No, this I do not know.
Okay.
You know, I'm not very great at banking.
Okay,
so tell me. Maybe I don't know something.
So according to CNBC, on March 9th, the company had authorized $500 million in new shares, but the Form D, which was filed on March 13th, became clear that investors had contributed far less than expected and had been reported, with only $221 million contributed to date, and the round was listed at more than that, and it goes on and on. I mean, it's a long article. And so they're not doing what those numbers that you're talking about. But look, I don't know who.
Interesting, David,
I'm trying to say who's.
You
I'm
were
trying
quoting
to,
a CNBC article.
Well, so that,
my source came from CNBC as well,
I'm,
but it was dated March 10th, and this is a few days later.
Wait a minute.
So
I'm quoting a blog article
right.
by TMFAssociates.com.
Yeah.
I sent it to you. You should
yeah.
have it already.
It's here.
And it's written by, of course, I don't know any of these people who write this stuff, so that's kind of pointless in terms
of
anything for me. But it says March 21st posted in Broadband Financial Operators Regulatory Services SpaceX at 12:36 p.m. by T.M. Farrar, F-A-R-R-A-R, that may be the author of all this.
Let me look at this when we break.
So you can look at it. You know, when I take the break between the first and second,
I'll take
segment,
a look at it and we can talk about
then,
it in the second half.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Let's go on to other stuff.
You
I will
can
look
read
at this
it.
Rather
so
than,
there's
you know.
No way that I have to do any due diligence with this. I just thought it was interesting and thought I should have sent it to you
earlier
in the day.
It is interesting, though, that I'm looking at it, and the author here links to those actual CNBC articles that I linked to.
I know.
So that's interesting. All right, well, I'll look at it.
But look at it while
I tease listeners. We'll talk about it in the second half.
I want to thank John Jossi for sending it to me.
Okay.
No, wait. John didn't send me this one. My National Space Security guy, Chris, sent it to me.
Oh, okay.
So I want to thank him for sending it to me. What do you see as the effect on some of the space industry because of the virus? I've been asking all the guests who have been on for the last 2 weeks, how do they see the effect? Some see it big, some see it marginal, not at all.
I think it really depends on the entity. It seems to me very clearly that SpaceX is looking at this, what I consider realistically, and is not allowing it to slow them down. I mean, it's not ignoring it, but it's not allowing them to slow down, because on a realistic basis, there's no reason to get slowed down for this thing. There's no reason to get slowed down at all by it. Other organizations that are usually governmental in operations who can't take risks and, like to not work and get paid, well, are very quick to shut down. So, for example, I posted today, European Space Agency has suspended operations on 2 of 4 of its planetary missions right now. The 2 solar missions and the 2 Mars orbiters have been basically put into a suspension mode because they don't have enough people in mission controls to operate things.
By the way, let me just tell you, you have a phone call waiting now.
Oh, okay, that's fine. And so they have one mission they're going to maintain, but they've shut those down. And the and Ariane Space, which says it's a private company, but is not, has suspended all launches of French Guiana. So, you know, to answer your question, it depends on the entity. It's interesting to me, the Russians have not slowed down at all, nor have the Chinese. And the Chinese, of course, have been, quote, impacted the most up to now, but they have not slowed their space program down at all. They deal with the disease, this disease is not, it's the most incredible overstatement I've ever come across in my life. As far as I'm concerned, the emperor has no clothes here. This is the most ridiculous thing. I've posted numerous essays on Behind the Black, citing the data and demonstrating that compared to the flu and other epidemics, this thing, though you don't ignore it, and there are things to do to deal with it, and it does, it's more dangerous at this moment, we think, maybe, not necessarily, but maybe for older people, but it has definitely been overplayed, and it's being used for power games, and so depends on the entity, that's much I'll say, and so let's go to the call.
Let's see who your caller is. Maybe it'll be Lord Gavin, and you can hash it out with him. Hang on. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Robert Houston.
Hi, Robert. Good to talk to you again. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good.
I hear we're going on lockdown in Houston. Well, that was you who told me, so.
Yeah, 11:59 p.m. tonight, we're locking down. They're locking down the city.
Going to California and New York.
I want to insert, I'm sorry, I don't like the term lockdown. This is what used to be called martial law. And they don't use that term because they want to hide the fact that it's a power game. So I'm sorry, Robert, go ahead.
Well, I haven't seen any military on the streets yet, and
we're still free to go if we want to disobey it. It's not enforced. So anyway, go ahead, Robert. Why did you call tonight?
I was kind of interested. First of all, I got to the show a little bit late because I was doing a few other things. But, the talk about carbon and water molecules being found in crevices in places like Mercury and some of the Jovian moons.
I was speaking specifically, Robert, about the theorized ice that might be in the permanently shadowed craters on Mercury. That's all I was talking about, not Jovian moons. I didn't bring that up at all. And I pointed out that the one paper on that subject at last week's Lunar Planetary non-existent conference, the one abstract, actually said they don't think it was ice, They think it was instead carbon molecules, complex carbon molecules, which is different, obviously. So anyway, that's just to fill you in what you missed.
Okay, what little bit I grabbed, I was wondering. I've always had an interest in extremophiles, you know, because we find life living in places on Earth where it has no justified reason to be there. You know, we find it in boiling pools of water and air geysers. We find it in our reactor cores.
Right.
And one of my, you know, hypotheses has always been that wherever life is possible in the universe, you're going to find it. It might be, you know, single-cell microscopic life. I just wondered if that raised the possibility, because if you do have a different physics or different chemistry of water going on in different environments, but didn't you mention something about Ceres having an ice crust?
Yes, that's one of the results that came based on the Dawn data. They now think that the Ceres has literally, they called it an ice shell, that one paper said could have a content of 80% water. And that would explain the cryogenic features we've seen that they think were ice volcanoes, that eventually slumped away, that can slump away, some have. There is plenty of evidence in the solar system of a lot of places, and you know this, but I'll say it for the audience, that you have water, you have energy, and you have a lot of other materials, all the ingredients you need to produce life. We have not yet found any evidence of life anywhere in those places, but that doesn't mean it's not there, nor does it mean that it is. I mean, you know, we just simply haven't been there yet to really find out. On Mars, I'll tell you right now that my impression of all the research, and this is an area I have been really, really, really focusing in the last 2 years to get a real handle on what we know about Mars and what we're learning about Mars. And my sense of the situation now is that it's increasingly unlikely that we're going to find life on Mars. That doesn't mean it's not there. I could very easily be wrong. I'm speculating. My sense is that even with all the ice and the geological activity related to the ice, having to do with, you know, the motions of that planet and its orbital changes over time, there's no, so far, any evidence of any features on the planet shaped by life. None at all. And I pointed this out on my appearances many, many times. If you just step back and look at the Mars reconnaissance images, orbiter images, the high-resolution images, as well as all the images from all the rovers, and you compare that to any image of any place on Earth, you see life ubiquitously everywhere. You can't get away from it on the surface. It's everywhere, and it has significantly changed the way the surface looks. It is a major factor in geology. On Mars, there's nothing like that. There's nothing. All the geological features we see are clearly geological features that they're not life formed, as far as I can tell. They appear to be inanimate geological features formed by the motions of, you know, ice materials. Now, that's at least what I can tell you. That is a stepped back macro view. And obviously the thing on Mars that everyone wants to see is whether there might be micro life there. The head scientist from Mars, from Viking, still is convinced his experiment on Viking produced a result that said life. And Gil Levin still lives on this, bets on that. And there's, you know, his arguments are sound in terms of science. You can't just dismiss it, which unfortunately a lot of people have. You have to pay attention. So I don't know if that answers your question or fills you in, but that's at least my perspective, at least from what I know so far.
In regards to Mars, there are two things. Isn't there a layer of highly saline water or semi-liquid water that's been detected?
No. Let me cut in right away, Robert. They don't know yet what is under the surface on Mars or its extent. They have significant, oh, this is part of what I said at the start of the show, which you might have missed. To me, this is the most significant discovery developed out of that conference, which is that ice is apparently plentiful on the planet. They keep finding it everywhere, ice. And there's lots of evidence that there is what they call an ice table, equivalent to a water table on Earth. But they do not know yet how deep that is, how extensive it is, and how far south it extends. And that's a very big unknown. And so that's ice. And in terms of water, they do not have yet any solid evidence of actual water, liquid water. There are things on the surface, two in particular, what they call slope streaks and recurring slope lineae. And the second one is the one that lineae are considered much more high, a candidate for possible seasonal water seeps coming out from underground ice layer. But that hasn't been confirmed. And with the slope streaks, they thought maybe this was a feature of a liquid process. But increasingly, it looks more like they're dust avalanches. Now, it might be, there might be water involved, but it's still, or chemicals in a brine, but that's definitely not confirmed. And if it is, it's very tiny amounts. So we don't know yet. And so be careful about that. Curiosity, if they follow their long-term plans and NASA doesn't cut off funding next year, which they are threatening to do and shutting Curiosity down, is supposed to approach two different recurring slope lineae and study them from a distance. They don't want to get too close because Curiosity has not been properly sterilized, and they don't want to, you know, they want to be careful about that. But they want to, they're going to be able to get close enough to watch it, see it, and get some good data. So that we will learn a lot more when that happens in about, I guess, about a year to a year and a half. I'm not, you know, their schedule changes because they're doing their research as they go. But I think what's going to happen after they finish where they are now at the top of this plateau, they're doing a drill campaign there right now. Once they complete that, I don't think they're going to travel much on it because it's extremely rough terrain, and I think that'll be too damaging to the wheels. They weren't really planning to be on top of this for another 2 years after they saw the lineae. And so what I think they're going to do is they're going to drop back down to the mud layer, which is much good traveling ground, and they're going to travel to where they originally were going to go up onto that plateau on smooth ground and on in the process pass that lineae. And their traveling, I think, will be relatively fast once they do that because they've already researched the mud layer, so they don't have the clay layer. They don't have to really spend a lot of time, and so they'll move reasonably fast. So we'll have better data, I think, when that happens. And similarly, when Perseverance arrives in Jezero crater in 2021, hopefully, that's a very interesting location because it's a crater that has this spectacular delta mud or material that poured out of a break in the canyon and apparently solidified into this really cool feature. If you go to my website and search for Jezero, you'll find the post I did, the landing site. I did a detailed description of that landing site, and you'll see the image. It's really amazing. And they're going to land close to the base. They hope to land close to the base of that delta, and that's also they think that might have been a river delta of some kind or some alien feature on Mars that it mimics a river delta, and that would mean water. It might mean ice producing something like it. We don't know. We're going to find out. That's the part of it. Now, in terms of life, you know, you get water, you might have an energy, you might have life, but we haven't found it yet on Mars.
Okay. My second point question was about, well, my comment was going to be about SpaceX.
Yeah.
I haven't read the article, and I've not delved deeply into SpaceX balance books, but it seems to me like so much of our national launch capability now hinges on the private sector launch capability.
Correct.
And yet Musk is very good at raising money, but he's also very good at spending it.
he's also very good not only at raising money, but earning a great deal. Yeah. You must remember that SpaceX in the last few years has made several billion dollars in launch contracts. I should do the numbers someday, because the number of launches they've had at their price, which are inexpensive prices, they've had a lot of launches. A lot of launches, and that's brought in several billion dollars. So he also makes a lot of money, not just raises it. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
There are a number of his projects I'm interested in. I believe one of the projects he was looking at was a point-to-point rocket passenger service at one point.
That is Starship. David, we have a reader here, a listener, who really should spend some time on Behind the Black on a regular basis. Starship and Super Heavy are what he's developing in Boca Chica. And both of those, Super Heavy is the first stage and Starship is the second stage. And both are being designed to be completely reusable. And both are designed to be very inexpensive to launch. And they're using, of course, technology that they have developed from Falcon 9, as well as technology that NASA developed from the space shuttle. And they're combining the two to put this all together. And really, the knowledge is here. There's no reason why it can't be done. If they do that, that ship could do point-to-point transportation. I think that there's a lot of barriers to that. But once again, the possibilities for profit are viable, because he could definitely speed up the transportation from one side of the planet to the other significantly from airplanes, and therefore he might actually have a customer base. So he's proposed that, and it all hinges on whether or not they can actually build Starship and Super Heavy and make them fly. And of course, that's the big $64,000 question.
Well, I think he'll be able to do it, because he's working on a process of basically building launch vehicles in an assembly line process where it's like one a week or one every 2 days or something like that.
Yeah, well, right, yes. The way they're developing Starship is they are building prototypes, doing tests with them, sometimes tests to failure, which means, of course, they lose the prototype. And they're moving very quickly to build the next prototype to do more testing. And they've been moving at lightning speed. The example I like to use is they did a prototype pressure test of their engines, of their tanks on Starship to failure. And the video is quite spectacular. It's on Behind the Black. You can see it. The thing blew up through part of it, blew its top off 500 feet in the air, came crashing down, made major excitement. Within 2 weeks, they had cleaned up the mess, figured out what the problem was, and began pressure tests on the next prototype. They were already ready to go. And that's a pace that NASA, of course, can't even come close to matching. So, yes, they're moving very fast in that way with this in mind. Now, this is prototype research, Robert, which means that it's not the ship itself. We're still far away from the actual ship. And we have to be aware of that, and, take everything with a certain grain of salt. But the track record of SpaceX is, superb. Everything he said he's going to build, he did build, and everything that he did build has worked brilliantly and has done exactly what he predicted, lower the cost to launch to orbit. And so I'm very optimistic about his potential for success here.
Yeah, because if you're commissioning basically one launch vehicle a week or one launch vehicle every 2 days, the economy of scale and the price per launch is going to plummet to basically be roughly around what you've got now for supersonic intercontinental travel.
That's his goal. So, he said this very clearly multiple times. Yeah. That's exactly his goal.
Yeah. So,
guys, I have a listener sent in a passage from the Reddit conversation where this SpaceX article appeared that I sent to Bob.
Okay.
And we talk. And it's too long for me to post on the blog, but then Michael sent me the link, which is also very long, to the entire Reddit discussion about this SpaceX matter. And Michael said that he would post it on the blog. If it's not up there by the time the show is over, I'll post the link on the blog. Bob, I sent you the full link to the Reddit discussion about this SpaceX problem on the blog, and I've not read it. I don't have time to read it right now.
Right.
So all I know is what I read in the blog article that I called to your attention earlier, but apparently that's just part of a very long, involved Reddit discussion on SpaceX finances. So, listeners, if you're interested, after the show, the link to this discussion on Reddit will be there. You can go ahead and follow it all, and you'll have Bob's comments. But I doubt that he'd be able to do much with the Reddit discussion until after the show is over with as well.
I'm looking at it now while you speak.
Okay, so, and I don't even know the history of how all of this came up. So, it is interesting, and if the article is right about the Commercial Space Federation saying SpaceX and the industry needs a government bailout, okay, so then that's what the Commercial Space Federation said.
Let me just insert something. On the Reddit forum, one of the first comments is about that link you sent me, that article about how they need
a bailout.
Quote, this is the same guy who said, quote, the Starlink project has for all intents and purposes been put on hold, quote, close quote, and quote, I'm told that the cutbacks went much deeper with a significant fraction of the Starlink team departing. That was back in 2018, and what that really was talking, he got his interpretation entirely wrong there. What was really going on and back in 2018 is that Musk fired the management of Starlink at that time because they were Microsoft people working much too slow for SpaceX's systems, and they weren't going to launch on time. And so he said, nope, this is unsatisfactory. So he got it wrong. And then the same person says, and this latest piece, the one you linked to, is also full of blatant lies, and I'd have to go through this now to see why he says that, but I do find that interesting.
Okay.
I'll look at this,
so,
David.
So on what Michael sent me, which I did not forward to you because he wasn't sure of the copyright, and which Michael is not putting up on the blog, the first paragraph is, this is the most heavily reported submission in SpaceX history. Our apologize. This is coming from our space. I guess that's Reddit SpaceX. We totally missed the clickbait title somehow. At first glance, it seemed that this was generally well-sourced, and we do like to accept things critical at SpaceX from time to time. However, it's clear from the discussion here that the citations are disingenuous at best, maybe even FUD, I don't know what that stands for.
FUD, FUD.
Yeah.
It's an abbreviation of curse words.
Yeah, I that's what I figured.
Yeah.
This source will be banned in the future. So that's the introduction. And then it goes, the same guy, so that's what you read just a minute ago.
Yeah. So, I see that now. That's the top statement on the Reddit page.
Right, and then whatever has caused this to be the most prolific SpaceX discussion on Reddit so far, if the guy's a fraud, I don't know why this would be the most, popular, Reddit discussion, because SpaceX and Mr. Musk have been on Reddit many, many times. But anyway, you listeners, you'll have the link to the whole story, and, you can, as they say, make up your own mind, but it looks like the blog article that I got is possibly fraudulent.
It appears they just don't do good stuff based on a lot of comments here.
Yeah, now,
and that's all I can say. I haven't read their paperwork yet, but I will tell you that my first impression, David, when you wrote it to me, was, wait a minute, that contradicts everything I know.
Well,
so I will have to look at it. It might have some information.
And as I will repeat, there's absolutely zero due diligence that I have done on any of this.
Right.
I got it, and I should have sent it to you earlier in the day, but look,
I'm
involved in a lot of other things. I do have another comment from Dr. Doug on this, and he said,
hey, Doug.
And well, it's just email. He says, I hope that Musk will spin it to demonstrate the placement of Starship into orbit. That will be enough to get any far-minded decision maker to realize the public-private partnership is the obvious thing to do. So that's something else.
Yeah.
Anyway, so John, anything for you?
Robert.
Robert, anything more for you?
No, I mean, other than the fact that I really can't reiterate how much I would put on that civilian commercial launch capability, considering the SLS is basically, flying boondoggle. But
you really should read Behind the Black Maw. You'd like it. Anyway, yes, you're right, Robert. I agree 100%.
All right, I'll drop off now and let you pick up another caller.
Thank you, Robert. We appreciate it.
And, pleasure.
Listeners, the line is available if you would like to use it and call Mr. Zimmerman. 1-866-687-7223. I just got another note from Michael who sent me the Reddit link. FUD means fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Okay.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. I would bet that it has multiple meanings.
I have another caller for you, Bob.
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you, and thank you for calling?
I'll just say Marshall, because everything else is already known.
Hi, Marshall.
Hi. In the conference, did anybody talk about this article I saw, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, The 1,000 Caves of Mars, because that's another place I would go look for water ice on Mars.
Well, okay, first of all, remember, there was no conference. Nobody talked to anybody. I was doing reports of a non-existent conference that got canceled from the abstracts because of the stupidity that is overwhelming our country and the world right now, the panic.
You didn't listen to the Sunday show, did you?
No, there were no reports on caving.
I totally agreed with you.
All right, because you know I'm into that. I do caving. But I will tell you, whatever article you saw about the 1,000 caves on Mars, probably was, the odds are very high, it was taking data right off of Behind the Black, because I've been doing probably monthly what I call pit reports on Behind the Black, coming from images that are taken by Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter of pits on Mars that they're observing. Most of these have been known for quite a while, and they're just doing high reconnaissance now, high-resolution reconnaissance and monitoring of those locations and trying to get additional data. But there are probably somewhere around 200 pits known on Mars. Most are located in the Tharsis Bulge near the giant volcanoes. Mostly near the southernmost one, Arcia Mons. But that doesn't mean there aren't others. Those are the ones they've spotted. There are pits seen in other places on Mars, but not as many. And that was actually a question I did ask one of the researchers who was requesting those images on this subject, and then Chris Akuba. And he said that that's a very good question. We don't really know why, if there are caves elsewhere on Mars or not. We do have definitely fewer seen or known at this point outside of the volcanic regions. Those ones we see in the volcanic regions are almost all related to lava tube type features. They could have tubes, passages extending off them. They might not. We just don't know. So no, I didn't see that article, and nope, it didn't come up at the conference.
The key thing that I found interesting is they had a pretty good map showing basically hundreds of them to the southeast of Olympus Mons.
Oh, wait a minute. I would like to see that link, Marshall, because that sounds like they stole maps I've posted on Behind the Black.
Oh,
they might not have. They might have put it together themselves. But I've posted very extensive. I keep assembling a map showing all the picture locations of the pits southeast of Olympus Mons, which is where Arcia Mons is.
Yeah.
So I'd really like to see that map because I have a feeling that I might want to talk to them about that. I might not. If they put it together themselves, all power to them.
Yeah. Well, Google of the 1,000 caves of Mars. it pops right up. In fact, there's like four or five sources, actually. So I kind of figure somebody did it, and, you know, it moved to Scientific American, and...
There it is. Scientific American, The Thousand Caves of Mars, huh?
Yeah, and then it's also on...
I see the map. Okay. That map actually comes from Glenn Cushing's paper on what they call atypical pit craters. And that's what he calls them. And this is basically this paper he wrote several years ago. And what they have been doing with Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter now is they've been going back and looking at those pits with high resolution.
And also at different times. So they can get some parallax to the depth, I presume.
Yeah, that kind of research. A variety of reasons to look again. If anything, as they also told me, they themselves might not be doing any work with those images, but they're assembling them as a survey for maybe future researchers might want to go look at them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is exactly the area I was just talking about. And so, The Thousand Caves of Mars, it's interesting. I wrote an article for Sky and Telescope, 8 years ago, on this exact subject. So this is just old news to me, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, my real point is, dang, there's got to be some really good places to live down there.
Maybe. There's some factors you got to be aware of. I was focusing on these for a long time because of two things. One, yes, caves are a very good place to work, to set up an initial colony because you have steady thermal conditions, you're protected from radiation, you can create an enclosed environment relatively easy. There's a lot of reasons where it's good. Every one of those features you see there are pits. They're not cave entrances you walk into. They therefore access in and out is not simple. That's the first problem. The second problem is I thought there's been stories about how the western flanks of Arcia Mons, which is the southernmost of the three big volcanoes that are southeast of Olympus Mons, how there is periodically appears to be clouds above the surface, water clouds, seasonally. And secondly, there is evidence that I used to think was a big deal, I don't know longer, of glaciers once having been on those western flanks. And so I always thought, well, gee, if there's future water clouds seasonally, and you might have ice within those craters still existing, within those pits existing, well, gee, that gives you water as well. But the fact is, this is lower equator locations, and therefore the question of whether there's ice there is an unknown right now. However, it's higher elevation, which, of course, we all know is more prone to have ice, even on Earth, and no reason on Mars. And I did mention that at the conference, they did find evidence of water ice, glacial debris, buried glaciers at the top of the northernmost crater of these three craters. So, of these three volcanoes, I'm sorry. And so, yes, it's a possibility, but it's not going to be a prime landing spot. They're going to land in the northern lowlands first because it's flat, it's easy to get on and off, and there's, as one scientist has said in a presentation, it's actually live streamed on the web. You can still see it if you want. This is where Starship's candidate landing site is. You could literally put a shovel in the ground and hit water. So that's the northern lowlands. And so I think that's much more likely the first places to go. It does pose problems from, you know, radiation, environment and so forth, but once again, we don't have a really good survey yet of what's there, and there could be caves up there as well.
Well, that's why we built rovers, right?
Yeah, that's right. Cars. Americans love cars.
Until next time.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thank you, Marshall. Listeners, we're going to take our pause here, but I will say that the Reddit link is now up in the blog comments the space show for this particular program with Bob Zimmerman. So if you want to check it out during the break when I read the sponsor messages, you're certainly welcome to do that. And otherwise, don't you dare go anywhere. I do have a caller on hold, and caller, you will have to wait until I finish reading and thanking our sponsors. And Bob, don't hang up the phone. I'll be right back. But we do have sponsors, and we are deeply appreciative of them. They do get the banner ad running across the homepage, which they can change as frequently as they want. On the full-length programs like tonight, I do read their sponsor messages that they want all of you to hear. Northrop Grumman is a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions for government and commercial customers worldwide, offering an extraordinary portfolio of capabilities and technologies undersea to outer space and cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us. Unfortunately, they have canceled their 36th symposium. Not sure yet if it will be able to be held later in the year. I guess we'll wait and see. But it is the end-all to be-all symposium and conference where the world and space connect. It's always in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor Hotel. You can stay tuned for developments at spacesymposium.org. Astrox sponsors us. They've been involved in the hypersonic space plane reusable rocket designs for the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for 30 years plus. Their proprietary codes, HiSight and SpaceSight, create and analyze such designs. And their homepage, astrox.com. They're in the Beltway and suburban Washington, D.C. And AIAA sponsors us, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the largest professional society in the space industry. And they have great conferences and regional breakfast, lunch, and dinner meetings. And their website is AIAA.org. They have had to change a lot of scheduling because of the coronavirus, so check their website for detail. They have decades of peer-reviewed papers, and you can access them. You do not have to be an engineer to be a member of the organization, so do check it out, AIAA.org. In addition, Moonwords sponsors us. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decision on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit Moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to help fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. Celestis sponsors us. They are the iconic global provider, Memorial Space Flight Services. They have plans for a robust 2020-2021 schedule with Earthrise missions going out of Spaceport, New Mexico, Earth orbit missions for later this year going out of Cape Canaveral on Falcon 9s. They have a lunar mission, which is going to be fourth quarter 2021. Hopefully they will be able to meet all these launch goals, but I guess a lot of things are wait and see this year. You can contact them at Celestis.com. You can include a little bit of your own DNA with the ashes or DNA of your loved one and symbolically make the journey with them. Again, Celestis.com. National Space Society had to cancel ISDC 2020. It was in a suburb of Dallas, Frisco, Texas. I believe they've canceled it. I don't think they're planning to reschedule it, but I could be wrong on that. You can find out more at isdc2020.nss.org, and we appreciate their sponsorship. And then we have the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. You can buy your own copy of it. There are two different sizes and varieties. All of this is available at thespaceplan.com. So check it out. And those are our sponsors. We have room for a couple more sponsors for 2020 if you're interested. And if you are interested, we'd love to hear from you. You email me at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And that concludes our break. Bob, I've got a caller on hold, so are you with me? Let's take our caller, and then you can comment on SpaceX if you want to.
All right.
Okay. Hang on just a minute. Hi, caller. Thank you very much for holding during the break. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Doug from Redlands, California.
Hi, Doug.
Hey, Doug.
Hey, Bob.
Hey.
I'm just joining now, so I'm not sure what all has been spoken about, but it sounds like you haven't really got into SpaceX yet.
Oh, no, we've talked at some length, but the SpaceX post that I'm going to comment on SpaceX and whether it's going to go bankrupt, according to this post, as soon as we're done with you. So,
Well, that's
I've talked at length about SpaceX and its goals with Starship and its funding and the money it's raised, though I have talked about that.
Okay, so I'll catch that on archives. Do you think that SpaceX is going the development of Starship is going to be slowed down as a result of this COVID-19 pandemic?
No, unless he's forced to by government, our government betters who have decided they rule the world now and we're no longer a free country. If California imposes its rule on him, martial law, then he will be forced to stop. But right now, he's made it very, very clear that he doesn't believe this warrants shutting his operations down. He's taking the same attitude as the Chinese and the Russians that while you don't ignore the situation, there's no reason not to go to work. And so he's keeping himself going, and he's definitely keeping full blast. So that's definitely a case. I pointed that out already in the show, but I'll repeat it. It's worth repeating because I really think the entire COVID, Wuhan virus, coronavirus madness is exactly that. It is a mob insanity fueled a great deal by social media, people getting emotional and not really looking at facts. I've posted repeatedly on Behind the Black the facts. There's just an overreaction of momentous proportions. And I say that not saying that it's not something to ignore. I'm saying that it's an overreaction to shut down our economy, create literally a depression, put people out of work, over something that really, as far as I can tell, when it's done, is probably going to be no significantly different than the flu.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
I've not talked to Doug about this at all, but he does have a show planned on this with me in a couple of weeks.
Oh, good.
But Doug is a bona fide, legitimate, actual MD public health specialist.
Okay.
I have no idea what his thoughts are, but I'm just letting you know that you're pontificating to a real expert.
He could tell me I'm full of it, and that's fine. But I'm looking at the numbers repeatedly from numerous sources, and it just doesn't. I don't care. It just doesn't warrant the panic. I don't see it. I just don't see it. And I'm appalled at the out of control madness that I see here. And we've had significant other epidemics in the last decade and a half. That killed far more people, that were far more risky to young people, and there was no reaction like this. And the flu annually, and in the 2017-18 period, was really significant, killed 80,000 people in the United States about, and we didn't shut anything down.
Doug, what do you have to say about all this? I'd like to know your thought. I haven't picked your brain
on this
at all.
I'd love to hear Doug's perspective.
Well, I'm open-minded to different perspectives on this point. I've read some articles that have made me wonder whether maybe there is an overreaction. But Bob, let me ask you this. You've pointed out that in a typical year, typical flu season, that, nobody's encouraging social distancing or any of these sorts of things. Okay. So let me ask you this. If China had not taken any measures other than what they typically take during the flu season, which is typically, just make vaccines available, I guess, but no social distancing or anything. If China took no actions to try to stop their epidemic, what do you think the impact would be on their populations at this point in time?
It's a good question. I think it's a misdirection. not intended. I don't mean anything slighting to you, but we're missing a key issue here. This is an unknown virus, so you have to treat it with a little bit more serious than the flu. We have the flu parameters are well known. We have treatments. We did not have treatments initially for COVID-19, so you have to treat it with a little bit more seriousness. No doubt about that. And the reactions of China was typical of a dictatorial top-down government. They shut the society down. It is interesting that South Korea, faced with a similar epidemic, very clearly made the conscious decision not to do lockdowns. They asked the public aggressively to do testing. They did aggressive testing. Tracing of contacts, so they could map the disease's transmission and pin down where the clusters were, and therefore control it. And they were able to get it under control without shutting their society down. And so the real question isn't whether we deal with this or not or ignore it. We don't treat it as the flu. We have to treat it more seriously. But the question is, are we approaching it correctly? And I don't like living in a country that approaches a problem like this, like the Soviet Union or a dictatorship like China, imposing martial law. I prefer to live in a country that I grew up in that treats a problem like this, like South Korea did, rationally, focusing its effort where the problem is, with the patients that are sick, and making sure they control the disease at its source. And so that's where my complaint is. Our government is not acting rationally, and that's been par for the course for the last 30 years. My commentary on Behind the Black about SLS and Orion and James Webb are just examples of the endless failures of our federal governmental bodies and even local and state governments as well for the last half century. They are incompetent and they're misdirected, and their prime interest is not the interest in the nation. Their prime interest is their own interest, and how can they garner more power and wealth to themselves? And that's why I am incensed here. I hope I'm answering your question. I think that China reacted. China's problem was being a dictatorship. Their first reaction was to make believe it was not a problem and then to hide it. And so, of course, that's not rational either, and that's typical of top-down governments. Once they recognized they couldn't do that, they then reacted like a top-down dictatorship. They imposed very stringent, strict lockdowns, martial law on their societies. And yes, that's apparently got it under control, but there's no evidence that such lockdowns really control things as well as a rational, careful analysis and tracking of those who are infected. And then asking your population to be aware and use, as independent, personally responsible citizens, use their common sense to not do things that will help spread the disease. Now, I fall into the category that is threatened most by COVID-19. I'm over 60. I have asthma. I have a heart condition, though I also am a caver and I'm very well, good condition. So my circumstances are probably not seriously threatened, but I am one of the top targets of this disease. But I feel, I strongly believe and think that it's a mistake to shut down our entire society and every young person to running in terror from this. The things we're teaching the younger generations here are horrible. There's no reason to run in fear. To quote Roosevelt, the only thing you have to fear is fear itself. And in this case, we are really afraid of fear, and that's terrifying.
Doug, jump in and tell us what you think.
I think you have to look at each situation with a specific – looking at the relevant factors for each situation. I would wonder if South Korea closed its borders in the early, you know, how early it did that, and that could really help keep it to the point where you can reasonably do contact tracing, where
yes,
you test them
did.
As positive.
They
and
did.
Then you draw circles around their contact.
Yes, that's exactly right. They did that. That's a rational response, absolutely. Each country is a sovereign nation, should have the right to control its borders, absolutely.
I think when it gets, when the percentage in the population gets high enough, that doesn't help much anymore. You've got internal spread, and you can have so much spread that your public health can't really do contact tracing for that many people.
I agree with you, but so far all the evidence with this particular disease is that we're not getting that kind of spread. And in fact, it isn't overwhelming systems. The numbers don't warrant this response. The numbers have not yet in China and in South Korea. And the Diamond Princess ship is a really great example because it was a controlled experiment. It turned out to be a really good controlled experiment. The infection spread is not throughout the whole population. On the Diamond Princess, where they were trapped, and it was an older population, no less, which means they should be more vulnerable, 83% of the people on that ship trapped with infected individuals in a closed, confined area, 83% did not get infected. That's a significant factoid to my mind. And same thing in South Korea. Once they got some control on the border and started to do testing and tracing, the population, it did not spread overwhelm the system. And I think in every case, we're seeing that, I think, routinely. The numbers don't match. So you're right. If we had a bubonic plague here, killing 40% of the population and affecting a giant percentage, my response would be different. I agree with you. Every situation is specific. But I'm now talking, my response, Doug, has to do with this particular disease and what we so far have learned about it. And everything I've seen, and I keep checking, maybe the facts will change, but the facts keep falling in line with these conclusions. There have been three different studies, one in China, one in South Korea, and one on the Diamond Princess so far, peer-reviewed studies looking at the death rate. And all three come in at about 1%, the bulk of all those deaths, pretty much, not 100%, but close to it, are over 60 years of age, 70 years of age. So that tells me that shutting down your society is foolish. You should allow the society to function because most of the society is functioning with younger population. And then the population within that should use some common sense with their older population.
Doug,
to protect them.
Doug, what are your comments on all? I'd like to hear from you.
I think the jury is out in terms of how bad this would be if we didn't take all of these measures. I believe that the transmission rate is higher than flu. The case fatality rate, of course, you have to age adjust it because it has a really strong bias towards the older people dying from this. I mean, if you get up to about, I think it was 75 years old, there's like about 1-7 chance if you get it, you're going to die.
Yeah, it's about 14%.
Yeah.
That's at least the preliminary numbers right now. Yes, you're right. I agree.
Yeah, exactly.
That's my age, guys, so.
I'm not far from that age, so, I recognize the risks.
I seriously hope you guys are not contacting people, I don't want to lose you guys. But what I would say is, this is sort of a big picture thing. I'm not so concerned about this epidemic as bad as it is. I've long been concerned about a 1918 level of epidemic. We lost 30 million people worldwide in that epidemic, and
yes,
we have three times more people.
Yes.
So as strange as it sounds, I think something good that will come of this is I think that we are practicing the skills necessary to be able to deal with the much worse pandemic, which I think, is entirely possible.
Doug, let me tell you, have you ever heard of the story about the boy who cried wolf? My fear, my real fear, is just the opposite, that this is an overreaction to something that isn't that serious, that in a month or two, the public is going to discover that this was an overreaction, that this is an absurd overreaction. Many people's businesses, livelihoods, and lives have been seriously damaged by that overreaction. So if and when a real epidemic shows up, they might not be willing to take the same rational response when necessary. Because I agree with you, depending on circumstances, sometimes strong action is necessary. That is why you have a government. But I fear now that this overreaction is going to put us in a very bad place come later.
So, you know, playing Monday night quarterbacking, you know, 2020 hindsight is always, you know, sort of unfair because, you know, people living it in real time don't have the value of 2020 hindsight. But I truly do believe that with the next epidemic that you're going to have looking at shutting down borders are going to be looked at and implemented more quickly, I believe. I think the ability to produce, you know, we are rationing masks at my clinic. I think that problem is going to be largely solved for the next one. I think, you know, as much as we should have known what was going to happen, it seems though we still were not prepared.
I should insert on the issues of masks. During the H1N1 swine flu epidemic about a decade ago, the Obama administration used up the National Reserve and then did not proceed to replenish it. And that's why you have a rationing right now.
Interesting.
So that's a governmental, that's getting back, and I'm not specifically attacking, by the way, the Obama administration, because I apply what I consider to be the overall incompetence of our federal government across the board, and that's just another example of it.
I actually wanted to talk a little bit more about SpaceX.
Yeah, let's go to that. Yes, all
right. I am hopeful that if Starship gets to orbit, that at that moment, I'm not talking about Starship reentering and landing successfully or whatnot, but Starship gets to orbit, that will be the moment that SpaceX will have demonstrated a capability about equal to SLS and something that any rational person would say would be far less expensive. Prior to achieving orbit, it's a development thing that hasn't proven itself. So I think when it reaches orbit, that there is going to be a tipping point in which decision makers, even if they, you know, have supported SLS, for those who don't have, you know, SLS is not being built in their district, then I think they would look at that and say, we need to do a public-private program because it is obvious that this is going to be more cost-effective and capable for even Mars. What's your thoughts about that?
I mean, actually, Doug, you're basically in different words reiterating what I've said on Behind the Black a few times. I think that Congress people tend to be, I have great contempt, as you might have noticed, for most of our modern federal government and the legislators that have set us up in these disasters. And they're not very smart, and their focuses are not the interests of the nation. And so their interests have been to have lots of pork in their districts, and SLS has provided that. They don't care if it ever builds anything. They just get the pork. But eventually, they are faced with realities, and they are selling SLS as sending us to the moon. And so at some point, they will, on a dime, abandon SLS when it becomes clear they can get the same benefits from SpaceX and Starship for and get it effectively, actually go to the moon. And so I think, yes, exactly right. When Starship actually flies and is reusable, that will be the tipping point. It shouldn't take that long, but that if it, it might happen sooner. As they get, you know, as Starship, for example, starts to do its test hops, 20 kilometers in the air, you know, 100 kilometers in the air, and then does a point-to-point or an orbital mission just as a test, and lands, that might be a tipping point right then and there, especially because we're going to continue to see SLS drag along and not accomplish much. And I will say once again, with SLS, what no one recognizes is that it has such a low launch rate, we're all assuming those flights are going to be a success. And I would not make that assumption based on, remember, the main contractor for SLS is Boeing. Boeing's had lots of problems. and in not just in its other, in SLS itself. I would be very worried about the success of SLS. So the tipping point might not be the success of Starship. It might be the failure of SLS. And the both, the two are in a race with each other towards the eventual victory to, of private enterprise in space, because that's the only victory that's gonna, that can happen here, unless we really become Venezuela.
Hey, Bob, I'm afraid I need to get going here, but always love hearing you, man.
Thank you very much, Doug, and I really appreciate your feedback and hearing what you have to say about what I consider the madness of our time.
Hey, take care of yourself, Doug, and stay safe. Okay.
Thanks.
Listeners, we can take more of
Let's
your calls.
Let's talk about Starship, David. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, okay, well, let me throw out
Starship.
My number
go ahead.
In case somebody wants to call and mix it up. 1-866-687-7223. Let me see if this email is for you or not. I don't know. No, this is something entirely different.
All right.
Okay.
I've gotten a chance to look at the, while you were talking about the sponsors, I got a chance to look at, read this, TMF Associates blog post about how SpaceX is going bankrupt and, needs a bailout. And I would say in general, this is garbage. It's opinion based upon facts, but spun in such a way to make it look the worst possible. There is one component of this, though, that they don't talk about at great length, but is an underlying problem for SpaceX. And I'm going to write about this on Behind the Block, I think this week, maybe this week or next, because it's been on my mind. And it was the first thing I thought when Elon Musk gave his talk in September of, 17, when he first announced Starship Super Heavy, his concept.
Uh-huh.
And it was, who's his customer base? And that's the concern I have, and that's the issue here. Do they, and this is maybe reflects on Doug's question as well, the tipping point. Who is the customer for Starship? When he built Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy, he was entering a business that had a very substantial customer base already existing that was desperate for a more efficient rocket launch provider provision, for someone to come along and give them better service. So that was a business that he couldn't fail at. If he could deliver, he couldn't fail. And he hasn't. He's been very successful. But I'm not sure who Starship's customers are going to be. The only ones I can think of are the government. And right now the government is committed not to Starship, but to SLS and Orion. And even if they decide not to build, they abandon that, are they going to pay, you know, is Starship going to be something they want? I think they will. The government, our federal government, has a need to be in space with manned spaceflight for national reasons. And so if SLS can't provide the service, then Starship can. But I do worry about that. You know, it doesn't work in real world field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. No, no, no. You have to build something that you know has a solid customer base already. And I have concern about Starship, and that's the one aspect of this that's a concern.
So your concern is their customer base?
Yeah. Do they have really a customer base for Starship? They're going to spend about $1.8 billion developing it so far. That's the investment capital they've raised, and that's the development capital. It's about a little more than almost four times what they spent on Falcon Heavy. And then once built, they say they're going to make it assembly line, and it'll be super, super cheap to launch, which could very well make it very desirous for a lot of launch companies and a lot of companies that don't exist right now because they can't afford to launch with what's available. So that's all potential. But there isn't a solid base for such a thing right now, at least as designed. I'm not sure. I worry. At the same time, if they can build it so that it functions a variation of the space shuttle but super cheap and reusable, then there is viability here because the space shuttle could put satellites into orbit of all kinds and multiple sizes. And so once again, I go back and forth, but that's a concern. This particular blog post that you sent me is bad spin, trying to take everything that has gone on in terms of investment and development at SpaceX and make it look bad.
Well, it was discredited on Reddit that what's his name sent me, Michael.
Yes,
sent me.
The Reddit people got the basically they might be overreacting more than me. They may be more hostile than I am, but in general, I don't find this very credible analysis.
Well, they said
it's a little overstated.
They said they were going to bar that guy from publishing on Reddit in the future.
Oh, really? Yeah. I wouldn't do that. I think that's wrong. Let his perspective be stated, because he might have he's not really lying. He's just spinning the facts. I think his analysis of the facts is really poor, and he basically has a thing against.
Well, here's one. Maybe somebody can tell us this. I don't know, but did the Commercial Spaceflight Federation really come out and say that SpaceX and other space industry companies need a federal bailout 2 days ago? I don't know that. I haven't gone to their website.
Well, I'm going to the link he gives. And the link he gives, unfortunately, it's Wall Street Journal, which is a subscriber, but the headline, lobbyists pile on to get wins for clients into Corona stimulus package. Now, he's spinning this. Lobbyists are pushing for bailouts in all ways. They're not specifically pushing for a bailout of SpaceX. They're looking for money for the space launch industry in general, and he's spinning it to make it sound like they want SpaceX to get a lot of money, and that's not quite right.
You have another caller.
Okay, let's go to the caller. Enough of this silliness. If you want to read good analysis about space, you go to my website. Right. Go ahead.
John Hunt from Fort Worth is our caller, according to caller ID. John, if this is truly you, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm an impersonator.
You're good at it.
Good.
You sound exactly like John. Exactly.
We could use a good impersonation on this show.
But anyhow, is it really? I have a friend that keeps asking, does the coronavirus really have actual red things sticking out of it?
Oh, who knows? That's that's a good question. You mean the graphics you see all over the place? I have no idea. My first inclination would say that's hogwash, but that's only because I know how the press is and how they'll play up visuals and fake things. If I was to go find, I've never done this, but if I wanted to go find the real image of the virus, I would have to do some research and get an image that I trusted. And I suspect that these colored images are not real. I don't know that, but I don't. Anyway, go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
At any rate, but yeah, I've been doing some analysis all along on this virus thing. It's not as good as some of the stuff that other people come up with. But I've just been tracking, I was thinking this Chinese situation, I'm not sure their health care is really up to the standards of what you have in what we call the first world. So I put a list of those countries together and tracked it. And when you look at the number of people that are not really being tested, because to be tested, you have to be sick enough to go to a doctor for it, first of all. And then you have to get through the criteria up until very recently, at any rate, to get tested. So I would say that at least 80% of the people that have it are never tested.
Right.
And therefore,
exactly,
they're not sick enough to really be on a ventilator or even in a hospital. So,
correct.
That's why I think the actual mortality rate is really, right now I'm showing about 0.36, and I even think that may be a little high, but.
Now that number you've come up with, 0.36, based on your analysis, which your logic is actually, I've read experts on the field, infectious disease experts who know about these kind of epidemics, who've said exactly what you say, John, which is that right now the mortality rate is high because we haven't tested everybody, and there's lots of people we haven't tested who have it. Based the numbers you've got, that point. What was the number again?
0.36.
0.36. Is that across the board all age groups?
Yes, that's the
okay.
whole thing.
That number matches very closely to the flu. Because the flu is about 0.01 across the board, maybe a little higher than that. So this is 0.3. We're getting really close now. And once again, with coronavirus, unlike the flu, more than the flu, not unlike it, but more than the flu, most of that 0.34 percent deaths are going to be in the older age groups, which means this disease is significantly not a worry for the general population.
Well, Dr. Space is worried.
Look, David, I'm in the same age group. We have reasons to be consciously, rationally concerned and deal with it. But
well, you're not in your 70s.
Well,
come on, you're.
I'm 67.
Oh, that you're just a baby.
I'm
in
a baby,
the woods.
Right?
Yeah, you're like John is. You're just an infant out there.
Right. But if you do get the thing, the mid-range person is going to have a bad bug. I mean, it's going to. I've had the flu a few times in my life, the real flu, and it's not fun. And it's
no, I've had it too. It's not fun.
But is it worth shutting down the country for?
Absolutely not. We don't shut it down for the flu. I don't. I strongly. You know, once again, I'm speaking as an older person. I don't want my country destroyed and the lives of everybody destroyed over fear. That is not based on rationality, and that's where I'm coming from. I just watched last night with my wife, rewatched A Night to Remember, the sinking of the Titanic, one of the greatest films ever made, based very accurately on documentary evidence that was compiled about that sinking of the ship. And once again, women and children first. You know, you focus your survival tactics on where the danger is and what you must do, and you don't destroy everything, and you act rationally. You respond to the situation, as Doug said, depending on what the situation applies. And your analysis, John, fits mine and fits. We're not experts, but I'm basing my conclusions not on my analysis as much as my analysis of what numerous infectious disease experts have said. This is an overreaction.
John, do you have any space stuff you want to talk about?
I'm frankly so sick of talking about
the virus and hearing it on TV that if I never hear the damn word again, I'll be happy. But
yeah, me too.
Do you have any reason?
Do you want to hear my comments about spending $2 trillion on it?
No, I don't want to hear your comments about that.
You can go to, you don't want to hear my comments either, but if people want to read them, they're on Behind the Black.
And by the way, if you really want to get pissed off, Trump is talking about spending $6 trillion.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is not a part of the thing.
I don't want to discuss it. I don't want to discuss it. What I would do is go back to discussing it. If somebody listening to this show who has a different perspective and believes what governments are doing is essential wanted to call in and state why their perspective should be the one that we're following, and he's happy that we are, or she's happy that we are, I'd be happy to air their opinion rather than just the same old guys that call all the time that all think alike.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'd like to talk about space, David.
So go back to space. But if somebody is out there who has a different opinion from Bob, I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah,
and you guys haven't heard me take a position on this, so you have a chance to convince me. Because here's the deal: I got a cystic fibrosis son in L.A., and I'm really worried about that because L.A. is a hotbed. But and then I've got pre-existing glorious positions at coming up on 74, and I live in a hotbed area, so.